Talking Inclusion with Stephen Copsey.
A very warm welcome to our next Inclusive Employers podcast, Talking Inclusion With. I'm Stephen Copsey, and today we're going to be talking about mental health. We're going to share our own stories, talk about what employers should be doing to support their workforce, and also how they can promote good mental health. Before I introduce our guests, I'll tell you a little bit about us. We're Inclusive Employers, and we support employers to make inclusion an everyday reality. Our mission is to make every workplace an inclusive employer, where every colleague values difference and can contribute their skills and experiences fully to their organisation. These podcasts are for anyone who has an interest in inclusion and diversity, or indeed in mental health. In our podcast, we share life stories and experiences, learn about best practice, and hear practical advice for employers from our guests, as well as Inclusive Employers' own inclusion and diversity experts. Today, I'm joined by two special guests. We have Jake Mills, an award-winning stand-up comedian, mental health campaigner, and the founder and CEO of Chasing the Stigma. Hi, Jake.
Hello.
And we also have Inclusive Employers' very own senior inclusion and diversity consultant, Addison Barnett. Hi, Addy.
Hiya.
We're going to start today's podcast with Jake, how he's dealt with mental health in the past and continues to do so in the present, and also when it comes to shattering that stigma that still sometimes surrounds mental health as a subject. So, Jake, can you tell us a bit about your story, first of all?
Yeah, of course. It's a bit of a funny one, really, because I'm now obviously talking quite freely about mental health, but I don't know if we would have done this podcast 6 years ago, a bit longer. I wouldn't have had any clue what to talk about when it comes to mental health. I wouldn't understand what you even meant by talk about mental health. And so how am I now running a mental health charity? Quite simply, because I became unwell. I didn't know that I was unwell. I was trying to make a career as a stand-up comedian. I was trying to make money at the same time, trying to navigate through different jobs, how I can make money and chase my dream at the same time, trying to navigate through all these different things and relationships and everything else, and just started to struggle with my mental health. But as I said, I didn't know. I didn't know the signs and the symptoms. I didn't know the things to look out for. I didn't know that other people were going through the same thing. I didn't know that I could get help and support. I didn't know that it was a thing that I was going through. I think I just thought that it was kind of just being an adult, being a grown up. I'd left university and I was now trying to make it in the main world. And I just thought that everybody was better at doing that than I was. And that's probably the main reason why I didn't really ask for help, because I thought, well, everyone's just coping better than I am, so it's not something I can be helped with. It's just something I had to just adjust to and adapt to and fix myself. I tried to bottle all that up, and it didn't really go very well. The longer version is how I looked at my own coping mechanisms, which became unhealthy ones, like using alcohol as a way of for escapism. But essentially, nothing else worked. And one day out of the blue, I decided that the only option I had was to try and take my own life. I can't put into words how far that felt from the person that I was before I was unwell. I never, ever would have thought that I would be somebody who would feel that. Never would have put myself in that category ever. But I felt like I had absolutely no choice. I decided to speak out about what I'd gone through. Not to help anybody else, just to move on in my own life, reclaim that almost. And so I just put it out on social media about what I'd gone through. But as a result of that, honestly, hundreds of people started coming to me asking me for help. And before knowing anything about it, my story got picked up in local press and then in national press, and then it went viral, and it was being shared by people like Emma Watson and James Corden. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I was just somebody who was talking about not being well. I wasn't expecting any of that. But what happened is every single time I'd done an interview, which I was being asked to do a lot by different charities, can you go and talk on this or can you do this? And I just thought it was the right thing to do because I was being asked to by a charity. One, that was leaving me really vulnerable because I was speaking out about things. But two, people started coming to me asking me for help. And I wasn't an expert. I wasn't an expert on myself. I'm still not an expert on myself, never mind anybody else. I didn't know how to help people. I didn't know advice to give them. I didn't know what to do. But what I did realize was that I had a purpose, that I had almost a responsibility that came with sharing my story. It gave me a fire in my belly to try and do something because I realized an injustice that was happening was that a lot of people were struggling all at the same time, but all feeling like they're the only ones. And not only that, I realized just how many people didn't know how to get help and support. And why were they coming to me? Why were they coming to just a little divvy from Liverpool who's not in special, not an expert or nothing like that? But it's because I believe they saw somebody who would believe them. They saw somebody who came through it. They saw somebody who would trust them. And that was enough for them to come to me rather than go to a loved one or go to a doctor. So with that responsibility came me saying, well, let's do something about it. Let's not just talk. Let's not just do these stories. Let's not just gesture. Let's actually do something physical about that that's going to make a difference to people. So if I'm going on television or I'm doing anything, I can do something that will change their situation. Just talking about it is only the start of that. So that's where Chasing the Stigma came from and then ultimately the Hub of Hope.
Just thinking about that history there, is there a time when you can pinpoint when you first started to suffer, but maybe you didn't know it at the time, but looking back in retrospect, what was that moment for you? What do you think that was?
So it's difficult, really. I think for me, there was a series of different things. There was kind of like physical illnesses and stuff that had gone on. So I was in hospital for a while with Crohn's disease. That was quite traumatic for me as an 18-year-old. There was leaving university, trying to get work, being in a job I didn't like in a call center, going on the dole for a little bit, trying to make it, relationship problems, a lot of different things. But you know what? The things that are not uncommon that I thought mental health, I thought, and a lot of people think is a negative thing, and it's not. And I also thought struggling with your mental health meant being at crisis. And I didn't realize all the little tiny steps that struggling with your mental health, you know, things having a negative effect on your mental health can have. And instead of doing something about it here, I'd allowed those to snowball and snowball and snowball and become something else. So it wasn't just one thing. It was a combination of a load of different things.
You've mentioned work at the time being obviously a contributing factor if you didn't enjoy the work, but how was your experience overall going into work? Was it something that you were dealing with, or was it, as you mentioned, one of many factors that was worsening the situation?
Probably had about three jobs that kind of went across the span of me certainly not being happy, if not being unwell. Not enjoying your job, not going into it and feeling like you have no other options is often a really, really difficult thing. But none of those work environments ever were, I would say, inclusive or encouraging to talk about my or anybody's mental health. There was never anything about your mental health. And okay, we're talking about 8 to 10 years ago. And yes, a lot has changed. But there's still a lot to do. And they were never environments where I felt comfortable enough to be able to say, actually, is work a problem to my mental health? And if so, is there anything I can do with it?
What's your mental health like now, and how do you manage it? How do you keep on top of your struggles, and how do you keep yourself mentally healthy?
If I was to say the word physical health to anybody, generally, people will have positive associations to physical health. They'll have something in their mind that will think of either getting physically fit, looking after themselves, eating well, drinking well, sleeping well. Even if you're not doing it now, you look at physical health as an aspiration. You think, right, I'm going to start doing that. I'm going to start eating better. I'm going to start going for a walk. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to take control of my physical health and make it better. If I say the words mental health, we generally think that that's a negative. We have an image in our heads of somebody struggling. That might be yourself, that might be somebody else. But if we were to play a game of saying word association, if I said mental health, you'd say depression, anxiety, suicide, schizophrenia. The other biggest difference between the two is that physically, if we're unwell, we're told from the earliest age what to do, to talk about it and to seek help. We know to look out for signs and symptoms ourselves. We know if we're not feeling well, if we notice a lump, if we notice a pain, if we notice that we're not feeling well, we ask for help. We go, we'll speak to somebody, we'll go to a doctor, even if you can't explain it. But even if you think about from like talking to children, how a child will quite openly ask a child, do you feel sick? Do you feel unwell? What type of sick? Have you got pain? Do you feel like you're going to throw up? We talk about it. We've got confidence around that. But with our mental health, even if we notice something's not right, we don't have the vocabulary to say anything. We don't have the knowledge. We don't have the skill, but we don't have the confidence. I know now that there's things that I can do to look after my mental health on a daily basis. Big thing for me is sleep. I know that if I don't get sleep, like a decent sleep for say 3 nights running, that my mental health is going to be affected. So I try to do that. I use this example. I don't want to use it for everybody and want to make this point, but physical exercise is very, very good for my mental health. The reason why I don't want to use it quite openly and say it because I think it can be used quite flippantly. It's not for everybody.
You've mentioned chasing the stigma a couple of times, and you've mentioned some of the stuff you're involved in, but what would you say is the biggest thing you're asked to get involved in when it comes to starting to shatter that stigma that surrounds mental health?
Around about 6,000 people die each year by suicide in this country. And of all the people who die by suicide, almost 3/4 of them are not known to mental health services or have not been seen in a year previous to the death. 3/4 of people dying without getting any help. There's absolutely no excuse for that. So that's what we want to change. And that's what I think we have to change as a country, as the UK. Our governments have to do something about that. But it goes back to the point I made before, is that people don't necessarily know where their help and support is, and they're not reaching out for it in time. So we created the Hub of Hope. So the Hub of Hope, it just started because people were coming to me saying, where do I go to for help? And I had no idea. So I just put out an appeal and I said, if you offer support, tell me who you are and we'll put it together in a list. But that then built into a website and now into a free downloadable app. And it's now the biggest, the most comprehensive mental health signposting tool of its kind in the UK. But we want people to know that they've got options. We don't want people to know that it doesn't have to be a one-size-fits-all approach. Find the help, find the support, do it when you need it. Don't wait, don't put it off, don't hope that it will get better. Give yourself a chance to get better by reaching out for that help and support. But for me, it just shows that it's a simple idea, it's a simple approach, but that's what people need. We need to move away from just talking about mental health. We need to move away from being awareness raising only. Here's the awareness, but now go and get help and support.
You've talked about how we've obviously seen a shift in society, you know, maybe not as big a shift as we would like when it comes to people talking about mental health. But, you know, we see celebrities starting to come forward to talk about their own struggles. But that stigma definitely is still there. Why do you think some people are still really uncomfortable talking about their own mental health or even admitting that they're struggling?
I think there's, if I'm going to really simplify it, I think it comes down to two things. One, education. There's no mental health education, really, in schools. Yes, they're starting to do it now, but it's not compulsory in schools, and it should be. The other thing is within the workplace. What we need in a workplace is an environment of understanding. And an environment of understanding within a workplace comes from, yes, the top up, but it has an everybody approach to it. Absolutely everybody in a workplace needs to be engaged in the subject and the topic of mental health. And that doesn't mean having a day a year or a couple of days a year when you say it's mental health day. So yeah, it's really important to talk about it and just say, we've got internal support for anybody who needs it. There's the employee assistance line, and it's just pushed out on something on the internet. It needs an everyday approach. We have to have an everyday approach to mental health. We designed a training program called Ambassadors of Hope, because we were seeing a lot of organizations where training, say, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 people, but they've got like 400 members of staff. So what we're saying is, well, you've still got a lot of staff there, like 380 staff who've got no training, but you've got 20 who have. That's still shifting. It's putting them on a pedestal. It's changing that kind of, it's not equal. You're then expecting 380 people to go to those 20 people. They might not like them. They might not want to talk about them. You know that people are worried about being judged, the implications of speaking about this. There's no more of that than in a workplace. Is this going to affect me? Am I going to get sacked if people don't talk about it? I'm not going to talk to Jean from accounts because I don't like Jean. So what can we do? My opinion, train everybody. Give everybody the skills, give everybody the understanding. Why aren't we doing that? It makes sense. Why aren't people doing it? Expensive, takes too much time. Well, okay, well, we'll design it in a short and condensed way. We'll make it as affordable as we can. We'll use lived experience, real experience. A lot of our trainers are from like a comedic background, performing background. We're just trying to humanize it, to normalize it, to say we're not making you experts. You don't have to fix other people's problems, but you should at least know the skills to look after your own mental health and what to do if you're struggling with your mental health. We know when you talk about mental health, people roll their eyes and go, oh, this is going to be depressing. Doesn't have to be depressing. So that's what we're trying to do.
If there's one thing we all need to remember about mental health, it's that it's good to talk about it. Next, Addison and I are going to share some of our experiences with mental health. Addy, can you tell us a bit about your experience with mental health, the ups, the downs? What's that been like for you?
I was thinking when I was preparing for this how I would describe my experience with mental health, because I think a lot of the narrative around mental health that's quite common tends to see it as a time-limited thing. So people say they had a period of depression or a period of anxiety, and it has a kind of start or an end. And when I was reflecting on this, I was thinking, well, so I've had several periods of depression through my life, each lasting kind of 12 to 18 months at a time, usually, for pretty much most of my life. And I'm 37. So the idea of sort of my poor mental health, if you want to call it that, being a time-bound thing, that's not how I see it. It is an aspect of my life. It is a part of how I experience the world. And I think it's, for me, those periods of depression, looking back on them, were obviously very difficult. And as I've got older, I've learnt ways to manage that. But similar to what Jake was saying, it's flipping it around and thinking about it differently. For me, my mental health and keeping myself well, I've learnt over time through a lot of error and a bit of trial what the things are that I need to do to manage that. but just the same way as I would if I was diabetic, you know. So as far as I'm concerned, I will have depression and issues with sort of chronic stress and burnout and that kind of thing probably for my whole life. That's just kind of how it is. So for me, it's about how do I make my life work with that, and how do I ensure that I'm as healthy as I can be, but also that I'm not holding myself up to a standard where I feel like if I can just find a magic formula, then I'll be cured and this will never be a problem again, because that's not realistic. You know, the fact of the matter is that there are triggers in my life. There are things that will happen that make it more likely that I will become unwell. And I'm much more aware of those things now as I've got older and as I've gone through therapy and various sort of different kinds of treatment. But they're still there and they're still going to blindside me probably at various points through my life. I've just sort of had to, I don't want to say had to accept that. I've worked to accept that. And I've worked to try and accept it with an element of grace, rather than seeing it as I'm saddled with this thing and it's going to be a problem for the rest of my life. One of the things that I've learned is that integrating and accepting all of those aspects of yourself is a really important part of being able to live as comfortably with yourself as possible. Whereas if in your head you're seeing them as deficits or things that are wrong with you, all that's going to drive you to do is try and sort of fix them or dig them out or cure them or chop them off or whatever it is and try and get rid of it. But that's for me anyway, that's not how my mental health works. It's sort of integrated into all of me.
So when we talk about that integration of that acceptance almost of, you know, it's a part of you and you've learnt to handle it in certain ways, how does that translate into the workplace, into your jobs, your employment history? How have you managed to integrate conversations around mental health, but also your actual feelings towards mental health in the workplace?
So I started my career in teaching, and the first 8 years of my sort of working life, I was a teacher. And as you can probably imagine, stress is quite high when you're a teacher. It's definitely a part of the job. And I struggled with that a lot. And I left the profession because I was burnt out, basically, which is can be a byproduct of being in that career. What surprised me was when I left teaching and I then moved into the homelessness sector, where attitudes towards mental health are very different to that they are in the education sector. As you can probably imagine, in the homelessness sector, talking about mental health quite openly is pretty normal, because the sort of service users, the clients, the people that you're working with, it's a very, very common part of their life as well. It just becomes a topic of conversation. Looking back, I think that the pace of work in teaching was difficult for me to manage. But the bigger thing was that it almost wasn't allowed to be a topic of conversation. Like, you were allowed to talk about, you know, being stressed or being tired or, you know, having too much marking, or, you know, there were sort of acceptable topics of conversation. But as soon as it got anywhere near being, and this is making me unwell, then doors would start closing. And it stopped being an acceptable topic of conversation. And the sort of message that I then got, kind of unconsciously, I think, is we don't talk about that. That's not what we talk about. You handle that on your own time. You're here to do X, Y, Z. The homelessness sector was different. As I say, there was a lot more openness about mental health, a lot more awareness. There's also in the homelessness sector a lot more people who have been service users then work for the services. So you've got sort of a bit of a kind of talent pipeline almost of people with lived experience getting into the roles. So that all helps as well, because people are much more versed in talking about mental health and staying healthy. I think what I find interesting about workplaces when it comes to mental health is, and you can probably imagine this is for lots of other subjects as well, there can be an organizational message, but then what that filters down into is people's individual experiences. So just because you have mental health first aiders, as an example, and you have a policy and you do things for Mental Health Awareness Week and all of that, unless you've really thought about your entire organization and upskilling everyone in that, like Jake was saying, you're leaving a lot to chance. And what you're probably ending up having happen is that individual staff will experience that through the filter of their manager. And if their manager is not comfortable talking about this stuff, or doesn't see it as important, or has their own hang-ups and stigma and stuff about it, then no matter what you're doing at that bigger picture level, it's not going to filter down. And I think that's something I've experienced over time. It's been more up to luck than anything else that I've had line managers who were supportive. Line managers who would say to me, your health has to come first. That has to be the priority, not, you know, deadlines, projects, whatever it is. I was fortunate to have had, and I have been fortunate to have had, a lot of wonderful managers who really got that. But I know from looking around places that I've worked, that's not the case everywhere.
You mentioned different sectors, having different attitudes, having different experiences. But also when we think about different demographics of people as well, there are very different experiences for people within certain demographics. And, you know, being part of the LGBTQ plus community, I think there's a real strong conversation to be had there when it comes to diversity and mental health too. What are your thoughts when it comes to bringing mental health into more diversity conversations?
I think it's very important, and the data tells us that people from discriminated against groups are at much higher risk levels of having mental health issues. There's a really clear correlation there. I think where we're at the moment is that, you know, as Jake was saying, probably over the last 5 or so years, there does seem to have been a bit of a shift in terms of how open people are about talking about mental health. People are bringing it more front and center. It's entering more people's consciousness, which is wonderful. I think from the LGBTQ community's perspective, that's great, because you've got more people going, oh, actually, maybe how I feel right now, I should get some help for it, or that, you know, this isn't how everybody feels, or I shouldn't have this response to this. That's a sign that I, you know, might need a bit of help or support or whatever it is. The problem is that sometimes the services and support that we want to access isn't ready for us. So as a member of the LGBTQ plus community, this is getting less common, but it is still there. If you're interacting with health services, it can be a bit of a gamble as to who you ended up talking to as a sort of mental health support person or whoever they are, and their attitudes towards you. So, you know, whether you're gay or bi or trans or whatever it is, they might make that part of the problem rather than actually just looking at you as an individual who needs to, you know, access this support or go down this treatment route or, you know, whatever it is to help you navigate that. And how about you, Steve? Has mental health been something that's affected you?
So I think when it comes to mental health and its effect on my life, really I could talk about a heck of a lot of different things. Even just in my immediate family, we've got diagnoses of bipolar disorder, PTSD, stress reactive psychosis, clinical depression, panic attacks, anxiety disorders, and that's just between four of us. So mental health conditions, mental health experience has been floating around me for as long as I can remember. I could talk about being gay and growing up in the Yorkshire Dales, how that affected my mental health. I could talk about anxiety at high school, at college, at uni that, you know, eventually culminated in a suicide attempt. But I think the thing that had the biggest impact on me was OCD as a child, obsessive compulsive disorder. And I'm sure as soon as I've mentioned that, we'll have a load of people thinking about germophobes or neat freaks, people that might be too nervous to leave the house. And some of those people might have OCD, yes, but it's much more than that. And there'll be some people out there that might be listening to this thinking, OCD, you know, they know me. I'm incredibly messy. I'm not very organized. That's nothing like the me that they know. But that's a real misconception there about OCD as well as a disorder. In its two key parts, you've got the obsessions, you know, the thoughts that intrude on your mind and will not go away. And then you've got the compulsions, and those are the behaviors that you're compelled to do, even if you know they're totally irrational. Sometimes they can be really connected and they correlate with each other, and other times totally unrelated. And for me, as a young child, this actually manifested as having to make sure things were in the proper place. Everything had to be even numbered. Everything had to be symmetrical. All doors had to be closed, not opened. You know, my mum loved it. You know, she didn't have a messy house at all. I was constantly going around, you know, neating up the rugs, closing the curtains in an exacting fashion. You know, if I walked around a table in a certain way, I had to walk back the exact same way to have some semblance of order. Even going to school, you know, I've got a real vivid memory of being about 5 or 6, and getting to school and realizing I hadn't brushed my hair that morning, and I ran out of the playground. I ran back home, made my mum brush my hair, then walked calmly back into school as if everything was perfectly normal. You know, obviously for me, that was something that was taking a lot of energy. It was taking a lot of time out of my day to do essentially unnecessary things. And the biggest thing for me was washing my hands. And, you know, it wasn't because I was, you know, scared of germs or didn't want dirty hands. It had something to do with that compulsion to do things evenly. So I would wash my hands once and then think, right, I have to do it twice to make sure it's even. And then it would be like, well, now I have to do it 4 times. Oh, let's double that up and do it 8. Okay, now 16, now 32. And I'd hit my sweet spot of 64. 64 times to wash my hands was, you know, my minimum. I'd be happy then. And that wasn't because I felt they were clean. It's just because that felt right. I needed to almost exhaust the obsession, the compulsion to get it out of my system. For me, you know, puberty was a real wake-up call. Suddenly I became a teenager and my inner laziness just sort of came out and was like, can't be bothered to do that anymore. Far too exhausting. So the compulsions stopped. Well, they mainly stopped. I still have a few every now and again. But for me, it was the obsessive thoughts that really crept in after that. I had no compulsions to almost order those thoughts. So then I started having, you know, obsessive thoughts about, oh, what if I die tomorrow? Where's my funeral going to be held? Who's going to turn up? Oh, my mum's going to be really upset. You know, and that could have been at any point if I was, you know, doing my homework, if I was, you know, just chatting to friends in school. It was incredibly distracting. And that's something I still deal with to this day. You know, every time I walk across a bridge, I think, well, what if I just threw my mobile phone over the edge? You know, I'm not going to do it, but it's that thought instantly comes into my mind. If I'm waiting for a train at the tracks, I think, well, what if I fell on the tracks? You know, I'd die. And then I'd get into that spiral of thinking about my funeral again. And then in the workplace, every time I see an email come in, I think I'm constantly thinking about what's the worst possible thing that might be in that email. And that's exacerbated if I see it come in and I can't open it because I'm in the middle of something else. So then it's constantly going on in the back of my mind. So what I've had to do is, like Addy, you mentioned, is just accept that that's a part of me, and I can't really change that, but I can try and deal with it. And for me, that's been learning to focus on one thing at a time. trying to get those little distractions to trickle away, to put them away in a box that I'll come back to later. Because if I divide that focus, it will definitely get divided again and again and again until I get to a point where actually anything I'm going to do is not going to be to a very good standard. Learning how to have those conversations with your managers, I think, is really important, and say, actually, this way of working doesn't work for me, and this is how I'm going to work. So for me, compartmentalizing has been a life changer. Learning to really log off when I've logged off, forget about work entirely until I'm back in the next day. But yeah, absolutely. There's been a massive mental health effect on me and my life.
Thank you for sharing that. That a lot of what you were saying really resonated with me, particularly about the inbox and feeling pulled in many directions.
Oh yeah.
Something that I try and think about is, I think it can be easy with particularly working virtually, but with inboxes and emails, is to see them as, it can be easy to fall into the trap of seeing them as an email rather than a person. So what I try and do, and I'm not saying I'm always successful at this, this is a work in progress, definitely. What I try and do is think, would the person on the other end of this want me to actually kind of be present and think about what I'm saying in my response? Or do they want me to write it in the 30 seconds I've got between two calls? I think they probably want a better response from me being present in that moment and trying to be there. Now, I'm not saying I do that all the time, but that's one of the ways that I've learned to try and reframe things a bit and try and get away from. So one of the ways that my depression can manifest itself is I'm very, very hard on myself. And there's a voice in my head that is very, very unpleasant to me a lot of the time. And it's a lot less loud than it used to be. As a child, it was like a shouting voice kind of all the time, basically, in my head. And, you know, led me to a couple of not suicide attempts, but pretty close planning of it, thinking about it pretty seriously through various ways, antidepressants and therapy. And I think to an extent, kind of growing older and developing self-awareness and developing techniques in terms of what works for me, which I think just comes with time. I've learned to notice that voice is there telling me that I'm not good enough, or I'm a terrible person, or, you know, whatever it's on today, whatever message it's trying to tell me today, it's got its little broadcast going, and go, okay, well, that's happening over there, but actually, how can I flip this around? How can I think about this in a different way? What's the bigger picture here? How might someone else see this situation? Something that I found very helpful is the, what advice would you give to a friend if they asked you this question? Because you wouldn't say to your friend, oh, well, you missed that thing because you're a terrible person. Like, you would not say that to someone that you care about. So approaching the same way with yourself, having that kind tone of voice towards yourself.
I'm going to spend some time thinking about the scale of mental health issues in society and the workplace, thinking about what employers should be doing, what could they be doing, but also what should we all be doing? Jake, to you first, what more could employers have done to support you as you were going through depression, as you were dealing with those suicidal thoughts?
It's difficult because if we're talking about it on a personal point of view, as I said, I wouldn't say that any of the places I've ever worked in have been particularly inclusive in talking about mental health. And I, you know, again, I didn't know that I was necessarily going through something myself. So I wouldn't have necessarily reached out to any of line managers or anybody else to say I was feeling unwell because of my mental health. I probably, in all fairness, would have said it was something else, made up something else about my physical health. So it's not a quick thing. I'm not going to say, well, I should have had line managers who would be asking about my mental health, because let's be realistic, they probably weren't going to do that because they didn't have training. But that's why it's got to be a company-wide approach to making people kind of, not making people, but allowing people to know that there's a trust there to talk about mental health. If ideally everybody has training, and then if you have a tiered approach, so some then are mental health first aiders, and you're making that quite clear that that's where you can go and speak to somebody. Having it part of inductions in every workplace, having it part of your regular one-to-ones and your keep in touch type of meetings, making it standard, just making it part and parcel of working and living in that environment. Because otherwise, if you don't do any of that other stuff, and then you have a conversation saying, how are you feeling with your mental health? So people are going to go, what? That was, I'm not ready for that conversation. I'll just say whatever I've got to say here. It's got to be an almost, this is going to sound like I'm contradicting myself, but a gentle constant message that needs to be there. So you do need to appreciate that health is health, and that's personal and private. So somebody, in the same way, if somebody's got a physical illness that they don't necessarily want to talk about, they don't have to. But you hope that they will speak to somebody about that inside or outside of work.
Addy, thinking about the context of the last year of people being in lockdown, people not being able to see people as much as they've been used to, why is it more important than ever for employers to start taking action to support colleagues when it comes to their mental health?
I think something really interesting has happened in the last year, which is that because something so massive has upended everyone's lives, everyone has felt it in one form or another. And what I've been seeing is more of the, what you might think of as the unusual suspects in organisations, have been talking about and thinking about well-being and depression and stress and loneliness. Whereas, you know, two and a half years ago, whatever, that would not have been a topic of conversation. What's coming up next is a bit of a risky time, I think, almost more risky than being under lockdown, because we're going from what's begun to feel a bit normal, because we've been doing it for a year, people have kind of adapted to it, they've kind of got the hang of it, to another change. And what's going to happen is that as people, you know, return in the office in more numbers, they start doing kind of blended working where some people are in the office and some people aren't. Some people are going to be desperate for it to just go back to exactly how it was before lockdown. Some people have had a taste of a different way of working in the last year and desperately do not want it to go back to the same way after lockdown. And the hard bit next is going to be, it's one thing to try and look after your staff when everyone is virtual, or the majority of people are virtual. It's a whole different kettle of fish when some are virtual and some aren't, on different days, in different places, in different ways. Fundamentally, the reason why this is important is that organisations employ people, and they are your singular most important, I hesitate to say the word resource because we're more than that, we're humans, but you know what I mean. So looking after that group of people, creating conditions where they are as healthy as possible and where they can thrive, whatever that means for them, should be your number one priority, because that then cascades to every other aspect of your organisation and every other element of success that you've got. So I think a couple of things for people to think about, organisations to think about as we go into the next, who knows, year, 2 years, whatever the future looks like. I think we're all a bit more cautious about putting time limits on anything now after the last year. One is to really think about what opportunities are there as people start returning to the office in bigger numbers and people are thinking about what flexibility looks like for them. What opportunities are there for you to sort of bake inclusion, and that includes thinking about mental health and well-being and work-life balance, baking that into this new way of working. So you've got an opportunity to do things differently to how they were before, because everyone's already kind of in that space where they're like, oh, things are new and different, what's this going to look like? So they're already kind of ready for things to, for change to happen. There's less resistance. But also really think about, okay, you might be doing activities around Mental Health Awareness Week. You might have all these sort of diversity initiatives, but are you really doing it in a way that's meaningful? So as an example, are you doing lots of things about mental health awareness, and you've got, you know, employee assistance programs and various things that people can access, but that's not really being backed up in the actual culture of the organization. So are your managers still seeing people who don't go the extra mile or who work 12-hour days? Are they seeing them as uncommitted rather than boundaried? Are you not expecting a pretty decent level of emotional intelligence from your leaders? Because that's basically what they need in order to create workplaces that are as healthy for people as possible. Are you still assuming that someone maybe, you know, being off work for mental health every once in a while, or, you know, working different hours or whatever it is, those accommodations, are you still seeing that as a difference or as a weakness rather than as an aspect of that person who you're looking at in the round?
Jake, as well as employers, it's really important for all of us to support each other. Do you have any further advice that you can share when it comes to supporting our colleagues, our friends, our families when it comes to mental health?
Yeah, one thing I would say is that know that you don't have to be an expert. Know that it's not your job, it's not your role to be that expert and to fix that person's problems. That's not what you're there for. Because I know a lot of people, even when they're genuinely concerned for somebody, still feel like, what if I say the wrong thing? What if I push them over the edge? What if I don't want to make things worse? So I just won't ask. And I can't blame people for feeling that way, because you feel like it's a really sensitive and difficult conversation to have. But you don't have to be that person. You don't have to be the person who's going to fix that person's problems. What you have to be is a bridge. You be a bridge between somebody feeling unwell and somebody speaking to an expert, somebody reaching that help and support. What I can't stress enough, and this might sound really simple and obvious, but if you're worried about somebody, ask them. Just have the conversation. I know you might feel awkward. I know you might feel like you don't really ask these questions. I know you might feel like you're not qualified, but actually just have the conversation. Do it in a way that, you know, is as normal as can be in the environments that you usually talk in the way that you usually talk. You don't have to suddenly change how you talk. You don't have to suddenly, you know, go all formal with somebody because you're talking about this. Just ask out in a way that you would normally ask them. If you can, you know, maybe have a look in advance on the Hub of Hope, for example, have it on your phone. Look at the help and support that's available, because once you do have that conversation, if somebody says, yes, I'm struggling, it's knowing what to do next. That's the important thing. Get them to that help and support. And the other thing is to know that sometimes it can take time. It's like planting seeds. That first time you ask somebody, they might say, I'm absolutely fine, don't worry, because what the possibly doing is waiting for your reaction. And or it could be that you asking them has made them think themselves, actually, why have they asked me that? Am I feeling okay? So they almost want you to come back. So ask and ask again. It's coming back. It's being persistent not pushy. And that can take days, weeks, years, but just knowing that you're there, because that's how you gain that person's trust. But it's just really important that if you are worried, don't leave it to chance. Just ask them. Just be there for them.
And Addy, how about you? Any advice when it comes to supporting colleagues, friends, family, when it comes to mental health?
I think other than, you know, everything Jake said, which is absolutely right, it's about recognising that, you know, there is still a lot of stigma around mental health, and people have internalised that stigma and that worry. And it's still something that all of us are sort of getting our heads around. So are there ways that you can sort of role model or make a bit of permission for being more open about how you're feeling? So if you're in a situation where something's making you feel a bit anxious, or you're a bit worried about something, could you verbalise that and could you explain it? Because then what you're doing is you're just starting to create a bit of permission for talking about how people feel. So as an example, in a team meeting, if there's something coming up that you're a bit worried about or anxious about, what's probably happening is other people in the room are anxious and worried too, but no one wants to be the first one to say it. So if you say, actually, I'm a bit worried about this, or this is causing me a bit of stress, can we have a talk about it? What do other people think? You'll find that that will start the conversation and people will get talking about it. And it's also, you get the benefit of starting to be more open about how you're feeling and making those things topics of conversation. But it's also about opening the door for other people to be able to do that. And then it can start to become a bit of a habit. And, you know, maybe in your monthly team meetings, you just have a bit of a check-in and see how people are doing. And it just becomes part of that everyday way of just being a bit more open about talking about how you're feeling, about being honest about when you're struggling, about speaking about things more early rather than waiting until it's kind of snowballed into a bigger issue. And that all starts to help.
And finally, if there's anyone listening who's struggling right now and needs a bit of support, what would you like to say to them? Jake, let's go to you first.
I would say that no matter how bad it might seem, and no matter how impossible the situation might feel, impossible for a number of reasons, no matter how impossible recovery or feeling better or feeling like you again might seem, no matter how dark it is, there's a way through, and there always is. You've got to give yourself that chance. Give yourself a chance to get better in the same way that you would in any other scenario. Give yourself a chance, because the way that you're feeling right now doesn't have to be forever, and I can absolutely guarantee that. I didn't think I could feel like me again. I didn't think I could have a life. I didn't think I could have a wife and kids. But I have, and I very nearly didn't. So I promise you, it's not forever. But you've got to give yourself a chance to get better. Look for the help. Look for the support. Reach out. Speak to somebody. But give yourself a chance.
And Addy, same question to you. If we've got someone that's struggling and is listening right now, what would you want to say to them?
What I'd say is that while it may feel like your brain is 100% accurate all the time, and how you feel and see things is exactly how it is, your brain can lie to you. And if you're feeling really bad right now, your brain is probably lying to you about lots of things. So that's not about just throwing all that out the window, but it's recognizing that this is how I feel right now, and this is maybe clouding the way I'm seeing things, or it's making it hard for me to handle even just everyday stuff. So what I'm going to do is reach out to somebody, have a chat with someone. Even if having a chat with someone seems like too much, there's other mechanisms, people like the Samaritans who you can ring up. There's online chat services where you can type in how you're feeling. But that first barrier is getting it outside of your head. And then once you've done that, you can start thinking, okay, I'm not very well right now. And again, key bit there is right now. It's not going to be forever. So let's see what I can do to get better.
A huge thank you to my two guests today. Thank you, Jake.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you, Addy.
Thanks, Steve.
For more information about supporting mental health in the workplace, visit our website, inclusiveemployers.co.uk. That's inclusiveemployers.co.uk. For Inclusive Employers members, there's also a link to our resources in this area in the podcast description. On the next podcast, the host will be Stephanie Hurst, and she's here to help us celebrate 10 years of Inclusive Employers. That's right, we're going to be celebrating our 10th birthday. We're going to be looking back at the last 10 years and how the inclusion landscape has changed. We'll look at what organisations are doing right now to help create inclusive cultures in 2021, and then look forward to the next 10 years. What's next for inclusion? What can we all do to make all workplaces inclusive for everyone?
You've been listening to Talking Inclusion with Stephen Copsey. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, then please subscribe and leave a review from wherever you get your podcasts.